you ever feel that God is invisible? That he is absent from the world? That he might not be active right now? Do you ever wonder how we should act in a world where others seem more powerful? Where governments seem to be in total control? Where God's people get sidelined? Did you know there's a Bible book all about that? Over the next few weeks, I'm going to be sharing my sermon series from the book of Esther. Esther's a book where God's name doesn't even come up once, but when we look carefully, God is extremely active. It's a book with conspiracies, misuse of power, supposed coincidences, relationships, and far more. Are you intrigued? Well, let's dive in, shall we?
Esther chapter 1, verses 1 to 9, page 501 of our church Bibles. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes, who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush. At that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. And in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials. The military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes and the nobles of the provinces were present. For a full 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendour and glory of his majesty. When his days were over, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days in the enclosed garden of the king's palace for all the people from the least to the greatest who were in the citadel of Susa. The garden had hangings of white and blue linen, fastened with cords of white linen and purple material to silver rings on marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother-of-pearl and other costly stones. Wine was served in goblets of gold, each one different from the other. And the royal wine was abundant, in keeping with the king's liberality. By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink without restriction, for the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the royal palace of King Xerxes. I wonder, how impressive do you find King Xerxes? I mean, King Xerxes, he appears great, doesn't he? He's the ruler of 127 provinces. That's spanning the Middle East. He throws the most lavish parties. All the leaders of the kingdom come and for 180 days have a banquet. There you see the vast wealth of the kingdom, the power of the kingdom. The whole point of this spectacle is to show you that this is it. Why would you want to put your allegiance anywhere else? The wine, never ending, in goblets of gold. More than that, did you see? A unique goblet of gold for each attender. All connected to how great King Xerxes is. How impressive do you find King Xerxes? I mean, it's not hard, is it, to be impressed by things? These words that open the book of Esther are meant to highlight that. And the same goes for today, doesn't it? We have people who want to show their impressiveness in the cars that they drive, in the phones that they own, in the homes that they live in. And that is impressive, isn't it? If you ever walk through the city of London, it's worth looking up at the sky. It's worth looking up at the sky because of the amount of buildings that stretch into them. Each building is seeking to make a name for itself. There are sheikhs, there are CEOs who've put their names on these towers to show their greatness. Who has the tallest tower in the world? Well, they must be in charge, mustn't they? Impressive stuff. See, in a world that has lost God, trying to be the most powerful person, it has appeal, doesn't it? You can effectively rule the world. You can put yourself in God's shoes. You can place yourself on the throne of the world. And people will find that impressive. We do find that impressive. And that is the world that Esther is written into. Chapter 1 of Esther gives us a world that is missing God. So what does it look like? Well, I want to make the case to you this evening that missing God results in people trying to plug the gap. It results in poor imitation, in knockoffs that don't fill the desire that we actually have, no matter how impressive they seem. See, Esther is a book that is missing God on two levels. Firstly, it's missing God. You might know that Esther is one of two books in the Bible that do not mention God at all. Song of Songs and Esther. In fact, some people quibble and say Song of Songs might. So Esther, in fact, is the only one that definitely doesn't mention God. God's name doesn't come up at all. No mention, zero, zilch. God is literally absent from the entirety of Esther. In fact, there are many versions of Esther that exist that try to bring God into the story. People were so troubled by the ambiguity and the unknown that they tried to make it better. Whole backstories were written. Extra verses were added in. A new ending was added. All for the sake of putting God into the story. And God's absence here has caused many throughout history to not count Esther as real scripture. I mean, how can you have a book of the Bible that doesn't even mention God? Famous theologians from the past, people we might look up to, Luther, Calvin, all sorts of people like that, passed Esther over. And even those who hold to it being part of the Bible, well, we still tend to ignore it, don't we? In the list of the most preached Bible books in churches today, I look this up, Esther is almost regularly at the bottom. Most churches relegate it to a women's Bible study, at best. Men, there's a lot of stuff to learn from Esther, okay? See, my hope over the next few weeks is that we're going to see Esther as a really important book and why we're missing out on a really helpful book if we do ignore it. But secondly, Esther is a book where missing God comes up subtly again and again and again. And we're going to see things happening that are a result of people missing God, of wishing that someone greater was there. I've got permission to tell this story. But you might have been in a situation where you miss someone. Perhaps you have a photo of them somewhere, or a keepsake. Each time you do something, you're reminded of that person, even if it's unintentionally. When Izzy and I were dating, or courting, as you might say, I'd go visit her in London, and then I would leave one of my hoodies behind, because my smell was obviously a comfort to her. She doesn't do it now, obviously something's changed. But it helps you remember the person. You do things, you get that whiff, oh, I've just remembered that person, I didn't mean to do that. That is what Esther does as well, as we're going to see. So let's see how this passage this evening does that for us, shall we? So first of all, missing God. And that takes us to how impressive we find King Xerxes. So just listen again to how he's described. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes who ruled over 120 provinces stretching from India to Kush. At that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. And in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials. The military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes and the nobles of the provinces were present. Xerxes, or if you look at the little A in your Bibles, King Ahasuerus, we've been practicing that for months, he rules over the whole Middle East at the time. You see, that's important. He's ruling over the whole of the Middle East. That's important because one of those provinces he rules over is this little place called Israel. See, in Esther, Israel has long been exiled. They've long been scattered over the face of the earth. Their people all over the place. That's really important. And in the time of Esther, some of those exiles have actually been sent home, back to Jerusalem to rebuild it. Xerxes' predecessor, a guy called King Cyrus, he declared that the exiles could go home. And some did. That's going to be really important. But some people decided to stay in the places they've been exiled to. We're going to meet a couple of them as we work our way through this story. But Xerxes, Ahasuerus, he is the king. He is ruling over all the land. And he's rallied all the peoples to a party. Historically, that is how the Persian kings conducted their meetings. I mean, it wouldn't be the first time a politician has called a party a meeting, would it? But the point of the party is to show how great King Xerxes and his kingdom are. To make you think, this is the kingdom to be part of. You're meant to be impressed. It's meant to make you be loyal, have allegiance to this kingdom. Hence the gold, the decoration, the abundance of wine. It doesn't get better than this. But just imagine for a moment that you were one of God's people here. You were a Jew, here in the time of Xerxes, what would you be thinking? Or perhaps even think how you would feel if you were to read this passage. Hang on a minute, that's us, isn't it? Now, once we get over the impressiveness of Xerxes, we might start to think to ourselves, why? Why are you telling us about how impressive King Xerxes is? Isn't the Bible meant to be telling us about God, about how his people are meant to live? Why be being told about his pagan king and his abundant treasure? Do you remember where we are in the Bible timeline? Israel has been decimated. The temple is gone. Where is God active in the world right now? Is God active in the world right now? See, the book of Esther, the name of the book, may actually be a wordplay from earlier in the Bible. Deuteronomy 31, verse 18, which obviously you all know. God says this about the exile: I will certainly hide my face in that day because of all their wickedness in turning to other gods. That phrase there, the words, I will hide my face there, is spelt with exactly the same letters as the name Esther. In the exile, God is going to Esther. In the exile, God is going to hide his face. God is going to be hidden. Does God care for his people in exile? Is God still active whilst his people are in Persia? In fact, you might turn that question to today. Is God still active now? I mean, it appears for the God that's in charge, it appears that if God is active, he's blessing the rich and the powerful, and that's if he's there at all. So you can stick up the posters on the lampposts, missing God. Yet, if we look carefully, there are things we should see that suggest people in this passage in Xerxes' day are in fact missing God. Like a child missing their parent who's gone away on a business trip. All sorts of things are reminding them of him. See, the average person on the street, they might not admit that they miss God, but the way they behave, things they think are important, show they believe something different. In fact, the Bible's clear that when we reject God, when we miss God, we try and fill the void with other things. In fact, we try and recreate the presence of God in other ways. And we end up putting our hopes into other things, whether that's our family, our career, our possessions. In fact, when we do that, we're actually putting our hope in ourselves, aren't we? We try and replace God with ourselves. We become self-sufficient. And the Bible describes that as trying to create our own Eden, our own place where man and God are walking together. You see, throughout this passage, the king words, they're underlying everything. Just look at the first few. It is Xerxes who is reigning. He's in the third year of his reign. He's sitting on his royal throne. The word for king, the reigning word, comes up again and again and again through this passage. Again and again and again, we're being told about the kingness of Xerxes. He is the one in charge of Persia. In fact, he's the one who seems to be in charge of the world. Although we're going to see in the next few weeks, that's not really the case. For 180 days, people from all around could come and see the splendour and glory of Xerxes' majesty. They can come and see how great Xerxes is with their own eyes. The greatest ruler of the world on full display. Although that phrase, splendour and glory, only comes up in the Bible when we talk about someone else. Psalm 145, verse 11 and 12. They tell of the glory of your kingdom, God, and to speak of your might, so that all people may know the mighty acts and the glorious splendour of your kingdom. Xerxes is a poor imitation of God. Xerxes' impressive decor is another example of this. Have a look at verse 6. The garden, we're being told about a garden. Why are we being told about a garden? Well, the garden had hangings of white and blue linen, fastened with cords of white linen and purple material to silver rings on marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and other costly stones. I mean, that sounds impressive, doesn't it? But that impressiveness, it comes from the fact we're actually meant to have seen this before. I mean, 2 Chronicles chapter 3 picks this out, exactly the same language again, talking about the Temple of Solomon He made the curtain of blue, purple, and crimson yarn and fine linen. He worked cherubim into it. For the front of the temple, he made two pillars, which together were 35 cubits long, each with capital 5 cubits high. He made interwoven chains and put them on top of the pillars. He made 100 pomegranates of gold and attached them to the chains. I think as you read through this description, you're meant to be thinking about the Temple of Solomon. It's as if Xerxes' palace is meant to remind us of the temple of God in Jerusalem. Even more striking that temple has been destroyed. Where is God active now? Is it in this palace? Goblets of stone, gold, wine in abundance, costly stones. All of this description, you can go and look this up, all of this description are echoes back to King Solomon, the temple and the height of his kingdom. And all of that imagery flowed out of the Garden of Eden, right to the start of our Bibles. The place where God's presence was at its fullest, where God and man strolled together, where everything was right, everything was ordered. Here's a theory for you. You can test it out if you like. Could it be that when we think something's impressive, it's actually because we know what we lost in Genesis chapter 3? The author of Esther seems to think so. See, underneath all the description here in Esther chapter 1 is a longing for the life that God created. And that life God created is impressive. Yeah, all of this is just a facade. It's not the real deal. This is just a poor substitute, as we're going to see through the rest of this book. But right here, we'll see what's been picked up by so many over the years. In a world where God seems absent, his absence is really seen all around. You could say God is conspicuous in his absence. As we see the skyscrapers, what we're seeing, we're seeing a desire for God. As we see the power plays in the government, we're seeing people trying to be God. As we load ourselves up with cars and phones and houses, we're all desperately missing God and wanting life with him in the garden once again. We make our false substitutes. We try and recreate our own Eden. Here's a small way you can see it. You see it in the way we use the word awesome. What used to be a word reserved for God alone is now being used for all sorts, isn't it? Isn't that building awesome? Wow, that sounded awesome. I want to make the case we're missing God. The author of Esther has written this story really cleverly. It makes you question all the way through, where is God? Is God behind that? Is that an echo of God? Is God there? And it gives us a realistic, a gritty, a messy story to find God in. The characters of Esther are not clean. They are definitely not perfect. In fact, they're just like us. They're real people. And they're a real mess. But the book of Esther trains us to see God in the detail, to see God in the everyday moments of life, to see God in the minutiae. So as we're trained to think about a world where God seems absent, it's going to help us to figure out how to live wisely in God's world. We're going to see more and more of that as the weeks progress. But this evening, I want to leave us with this. Just as Esther's author does, I want us to be thinking about the kingdom behind the scenes, where things truly are awesome, where things really are satisfying, where it really is that things don't get better than this. The kingdom that we're called to look at and align ourselves to because, well, why wouldn't you? And that means not falling for false Edens, not falling for things that are looking impressive but are of poor imitation. It'd be a waste of our life to fall for those things. And when we do that, we're going to have a bigger view of who God is, and we'll be able to live for him better in this world.
Thank you so much for listening. Any feedback or questions can be sent to podcast@david-couch.com, and I'll catch you again next time.